Welcome to this session on the American Dream. I'm Luther Lutke. I will be your presenter and discussion leader on this topic. My purpose during the coming hour is to help us communally give focus and clarity to the concept of the American Dream, which I venture is probably one of the most shop-worn and frequently encountered epigraphs that we're experiencing in now the 1980s. The American Dream is a phrase that trips lightly off the lips of politicians, of sociologists, journalists, even churchmen alike, and it's a phrase I'm sure that we've all encountered and probably used at some time or the other. A couple of the great recent expressions of the American Dream were Martin Luther King's March on Washington address in the 1960s and Jimmy Carter's inaugural address, which was constructed largely out of rhetoric surrounding that. Even churchmen have felt compelled to address this phrase in a slim book, which I seem to have lost yesterday. Professors Benny and Hefner of our seminary in Chicago gave a Christian critique of the American Dream, recognizing it as a concept of enough motive power, enough moving power, that the church itself must take a stance vis-a-vis this concept. I think to begin with, I should simply remind us all of the power that mottos and slogans and epigraphs and labels and images have in the shaping of national consciousness as in the shaping of our individual psychologies. Slogans of various kinds have been rallying cries for the American people. At different moments in our history, there were such slogans as God's New Israel, In God We Trust, E Pluribus Unum, Manifest Destiny, Go West, Young Man, The Melting Pot, Make the World Safe for Democracy. You can plug your own into this. Remember the Maine 5440 fight, all of the things that we were filled with in high school civics, if not before, have helped us to define what it is to be an American, what our origins, our present purpose, and our future destinies may be. Today, many of these early creative labels have been submerged into this very vague and amorphous phrase, the American Dream, which I think a quantitative analysis would show has pretty much elbowed aside some of the earlier phrases that I've already mentioned. But what does the phrase, the American Dream, mean? Where did it come from? Where is it leading us? I first encountered or employed the phrase myself in a half-serious way in 1974 when I offered a sophomore and junior college-level course in American literature and social thought, which I very cavalierly called the American Dream. Occasionally, we have an opportunity to teach at a general university a course entirely of our own design, one which is not prescribed by the catalog or even required by majors. And I thought the American Dream would give me all sorts of license and liberty to work out some of my pet ideas about major documents and expressions in American culture. And indeed it did, but as the semester went along, I became less and less sure what it was that I was talking about. And as I encountered faculty at other universities and colleges who had also taught courses called the American Dream, we discovered that our concepts were radically different. The kinds of documentation that we appealed to was not at all unanimous. And at the end of that semester, I really felt a little downcast. Maybe because of my compulsive Protestant nature, I thought I really should know more about what I was dealing with. And for a year and a half, I continued to talk to people about this phrase, the American Dream, and to be aware of ways in which it was used in public speech and oratory. And finally, in 1975, on the eve of the American Bicentennial, I decided to try to get a more serious grasp in the meaning, the origins, the significance of the term than I had had up to that point. And with the aid of a couple of very able graduate students, I approached this from two directions, the results of which I'll be sharing with you tonight. And one was to compile a bibliography of essays, dissertations, monographs, public addresses, movies, novels, plays, poems, and so forth, which had used that phrase, the American dream. And I hoped at this point to inductively come to a categorization of the American dream, recognizing that most times people were using the phrase simply to express a pet idea of their own, to project yet another impression about America. But I thought I would approach it from the opposite direction and find out now how the phrase had been used, and then to discover whether it fell into separate piles or not. And using some of our computer technology, I've in the last couple of years also been able to run checks of standard bibliographic bases to find out where the phrase has been used in 400 or 500 different places over the last 10 or 15 years. Simultaneously, one of my graduate students also volunteered to do some interviews with prominent personalities on their concepts of the American dream. The tape that's in front of you tonight contains snippets of some of the interviews which he conducted, all of which were very spontaneous and were captured on the spot with people like William Buckley and Ronald Reagan and F. Lee Bailey and Jane Fonda and Monty Hall, Carl Bowman, and so forth, some of which we'll be hearing tonight. When enough data was in, categories indeed did begin to emerge. And I will be sharing with you four major categories of usage for this phrase, the American dream. I'm afraid, however, if I continue at that point, that I might prejudice or limit our discussion too much. I would like to pause at this moment for perhaps 10 minutes or so and have us pool our own experiences or fresh ideas about what the American dream means, how you've encountered it, whether you've received it favorably, skeptically, sardonically, critically, what your reaction might be. So let me open the house for a few minutes first and hear from you before we return here.
You want to know what our idea is of an American dream? Is that it?
Right. Either personally or how you see other people using the term.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, I would feel that my American dream would be a happy marriage, happy household, happy children, nice family, not wealth, but good living.
Mm-hmm. Do you think is that distinctively a wish of Americans?
Yeah.
Is there anything that defines that to our country?
No, I don't think so. That's probably the dream of everybody.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't necessarily be an American dream.
But that is an American dream, which is often expressed, and people seem to hold the expectation that it can be realized in America more easily than in other places. Other observations? Yes?
My idea of an American dream would be to wipe out hunger in this country.
Mm-hmm. That's very specific.
I didn't hear what you said.
Doris said to wipe out hunger in this country, which implies a wrong to begin with, and a wrong that should be righted, perhaps in a programmatic way.
Mm-hmm. Everybody have a job. Wipe out unemployment.
Okay, full employment.
Would all those things be included in what I said?
Yes. There's a counterpoint here between the family-centered approach and a social or class-centered approach. Mm-hmm. Yes?
How about world peace?
How about it? That's a very good idea. And it is an American dream. I'll be talking more about the international implications of American thought also in a session that I hope to do next week on called Civil Religion. The very back of the room.
The way I see other people seeing their American dream is that they've got their piece of whatever it is, and they're going to hang on to it, come hell or high water, and they're going to do to it what they want to do to it. And they are not going to be interfered with by other people, quote, government, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
And
like to attach any names to that of public figures or valid propositions?
No, but I could generalize on certain categories of jobs, maybe.
For example?
Certain people in businesses, that it's their business to do that and to encourage that so that people will feel that their piece of ground is their piece of ground, you know, and they have no obligations to anything or anybody. As long as they're on their turf. But I think I see the American Dream coming at, from other people coming to this country as being a place where they are free from tyranny.
And certainly the immigration into this country now of the Koreans, of the Cubans, and the continuing influx of Mexicans and Latin Americans stokes the fires of the melting pot.
How about freedom of religion, freedom of speech?
The famous freedoms of religion and speech, very definitely. Let's add a couple more to this, and then we may have more time for this after Zara. Just
freedom of choice.
Yeah.
One of the great catchwords that we're just hearing right now often in a variety of ways is freedom. And on the one hand, it's freedom from interference. And on the other hand, we talk about freedom in a different sense of freedom from hunger, freedom from unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
So it's freedom in a social sense and in a privatistic sense. But freedom is one of the great catchwords of the American dream.
Although the remark made in the very back suggests a consciousness that perhaps we're approaching steady state and that we cannot continually expand our mining and processing of natural resources, so that freedom to protect what we have is going to hamper people's freedom to attain what we already have. Larry?
I think a lot of people imagine the American dream to be a high standard of living, essentially there for private enjoyment, and available to all, in such a way that those who have it won't have to give it up in order that some others may join them.
Mm-hmm. As you express that, the concept has not only a material dimension and a social dimension, but also a spiritual dimension. Perhaps implicit within it.
There's a set of ideals there. Mm-hmm.
One other thought is freedom to do and to say what one wants to do or say, so long as it doesn't infringe on the rights of others.
That is almost verbatim one of the quotations that you'll have from Ronald Reagan on this.
I never heard of that.
I say that without political prejudice.
I thought it was my own.
Let me take one or two more remarks. Yes, upstairs.
How about the opportunity to make of yourself what you want to?
Mm-hmm. Very good.
That's what I associate with American
mm-hmm. Individualism, freedom for self-development.
Yes.
And finally, in fact,
I hear out of our group coming a lot of ideals, when in reality, I'm a banker, and I know what many of people have for the American dream. It is material. It is a new home, a new car, a new boat, and only of late have people been forced to reevaluate. But here, we're very idealistic.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not what's happening out there in the real world.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's good. In one way or another, all of these comments anticipate or reflect the main patterns of usage for the American dream in public speech. What I would like to do now, hoping that there will be some time at the end also, is to present in a more structured way the data that has been gathered, beginning with the earliest located usage of the term that we have been able to locate. I think if I put the question to you in a non-rhetorical way, you would say the American dream surely must date from the 19th century, if not indeed from the 18th century. It sounds like a phrase that should have been around for a long time. But perhaps ironically, the earliest use of that specific phrase that I've been able to identify is 1931. In a book review which James Thurslow Adams wrote for Catholic World. In earlier periods, there are near cognate phrases. The hope of America, the promise of America, the expectation, mission, destiny, and so forth. And in a couple of poems by the famous black poet Langston Hughes, in the late 1920s, he uses America and dreams in an apposite position, one right next to the other. But the label itself, the American dream, appears not to have crystallized, or at least not to have caught on, until 1931. Which makes for some interesting contemplation. Why that date? Why didn't it appear earlier? Why in 1931? I think there are two explanations that come pretty much to hand, which may help us diagnose it. And first of all is to realize that this was 2 years after the stock market crash had plunged this country into certainly the worst depression that we've had in the 20th century. And if we date the economic slide of the country from 1929, when the collapse of the stock market, until the nadir of the depression in 1933, conveniently 1931 appears exactly halfway along the way. And this does make, I think, a kind of refracted sense. Because so long as reality is sufficient, so long as expectation is fulfilled in some public way, one does not need to talk about dreams. Then one talks about realities. It's only when the harsh social realities betray public expectations that people are liable to move over into the area of dreaming. And to some extent, whenever the phrase the American dream is used today, it brings along with itself this cloud of illusion, of false expectation, of defeated hopes with it. This is certainly true in the way the phrase is used by our writers. Norman Mailer's novel, An American Dream, Edward Albee's play, The American Dream, Hunter Thompson's acid novel. Hunter Thompson is the character behind Doonesbury's Uncle Duke, and he wrote for Rolling Stone and did a novel called Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, In Search of the American Dream. And Sam Shepard's recent plays also have all dealt with the American dream as nightmare, as destruction rather than fulfillment. But there's a second reason, perhaps, why this phrase was liable to appear in 1931 and the 1930s at all, and that would be the popularity of dream psychology in American culture during the 1920s. The 1920s is a period in which both popular and academic psychology was based very much on the investigation of dreams through Freud, to an extent also through Jung. And regarded in this way, the investigation of dreams discovers not unreality, but instead a deeper reality, a consciousness that's below the surface, and which perhaps can reveal some individual and corporate truths. In any case, the term caught on steadily through the 1930s, and it appears again in 1932 and 1933 and 1934 and during the Second World War, and there has been a geometrical progression in the manifestations of the term right down to 1980. I'm going to proceed at this point to identify four of the principal ways in which the phrase has been used, but I caution you to keep in mind that I'm being unhistorical whenever I use the phrase the American dream to refer to thoughts or to behavior before the year 1931. We are not using the term that would have been in the minds of the people in earlier periods. They would have conceived of themselves in a different way. And what we might call their American dreams, they would have expressed differently. There are four main conceptual uses of the American dream, which I'm going to present in chronological order. And conveniently, they refer to developments in 17th, 18th, 19th, and 20th century America. And by the time we gather all of the uses of the label together, we have a near intellectual history of the United States. The first use of the dream, not in order of appearance, but just in my order of presentation, is to refer to the sense of religious calling which the early Puritans brought to this country and which has been shared by generations of Americans since, and which is almost ritualistically repeated in inaugural addresses and 4th of July addresses, and sometimes also in State of the Union messages. The Puritans who left England in 1629, 1630 to establish the Massachusetts Bay Colony, some 11 ships and I guess it's 700 of them in all, in 1630, brought with them from the Old World a sense of sending, a sense of divine calling also to this country. They removed themselves from a world in which they did not have free practice of their religion and brought a charter to establish in the area of Massachusetts Bay a model Bible commonwealth. They saw themselves as embarked on a holy mission, not only for themselves, but for the world, to create a human society after the model of the Bible. They call themselves God's New Israel, borrowing the imagery of the Old Testament, particularly as they fled a pharaonic persecution and sought their promised land on the other side of the Atlantic. The classical statement of this notion of a Puritan calling is a sermon by John Winthrop, who is the leader of the company and who drafted a sermon called A Model of Christian Charity, which he delivered on board his flagship Arabella in 1630, before the Puritans landed in the New World. And in his Model of Christian Charity, Winthrop sought to inspire his people to the selflessness and to the respect for social order which would be necessary if they were to live harmoniously in the New Land. I would like to read to you a section near the end of this Puritan sermon in 1630, because in one way or another the same concept continues to pop up until today, and I think it's one that we can weigh on our hearts also. Winthrop has admonished the people both of the great opportunity given to them to establish a model community and a model church, and he's also admonished them of the consequences of failure. For if they were to fail in this last attempt, in this last opportunity to create a community of godly men, then God surely would turn his face against them and they would perish from the earth. Now, the only way to avoid this shipwreck of a broken covenant, he said, and to provide for our posterity is to follow the counsel of Micah, to do justly, to love mercy, to walk humbly with our God. For this end, we must be knit together in this work as one man. We must entertain each other in brotherly affection. We must be willing to abridge ourselves of superfluities for the supply of others' necessities. We must uphold a familiar commerce together in all meekness, gentleness, patience, and liberality. We must delight in each other, make others' conditions our own, rejoice together, mourn together, labor and suffer together, always having before our eyes our commission and community in the work. Our community is members of the same body. So shall we keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. The Lord will be our God and delight to dwell among us as his own people, and will command a blessing upon us in all our ways, so that we shall see much more of his wisdom, power, goodness, and truth than formerly we have been acquainted with. We shall find that the God of Israel is among us, when 10 of us shall be able to resist 1,000 of our enemies, when he shall make us a praise and glory, that men shall say of succeeding plantations, the Lord make it like that of New England. And here is the part that is so often anthologized in American intellectual histories. For we must consider that we shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us, so that if we shall deal falsely with our God in this work we have undertaken, and so cause him to withdraw his present help from us, then shall we shame the faces of many of God's worthy servants, and cause their prayers to be turned into curses upon us, till we be consumed out of the good land whither we are going. An effective strategic device which Winthrop uses in the sermon is to offer the great opportunity to study God directly and to duplicate as best as possible his will in a human community, and on the other hand, to warn them of the consequences of failure in this holy covenant. I would like to illustrate a contemporary of Winthrop's thought with a brief statement by Ronald Reagan. It seems even more timely today, perhaps, than it did 4 years ago when this tape recording was made. And I'll play it without any more introduction, except to say this, that in his 2 or 3 minute statement, Reagan moves from really one definition of the American dream to another, and then comes out at the end to make a religious affirmation of America's rendezvous with destiny as the people of God. And one thing we discovered most often when taping these interviews was that people would become more ethereal and spiritualized as they spoke for 2 or 3 minutes about their concepts of the American dream. The speaker for this is in the back of the room, and I'll try to crank up the sound so it'll be comfortable for all of us.
To me, the American dream is to be whatever God intended you should be, that each individual should have the right to try, to fail, to try again, to be, to fly as high and far as his own strength will take him without being restricted or penalized, so long as he does not impose on someone else's right to do the same thing.
Okay, what do you think the goals this country should have in the next 100 years?
Well, I think the goal that we should have for the next 100 years should be the goal that we've had for the last 200 and that seems to be somewhat watered down and compromised today. And that is to achieve the ultimate in individual freedom consistent with an orderly society.
How would you go about that? Can you just talk some specifics on how that could be implemented?
Well, I think to review all those places where we strayed from that path and that toward that goal, to the place that we have restricted freedom. We do have the collective government interfering with the right of the individual in so many ways. And we need to, like any traveler lost in the woods, stop and look at the compass and which side of the tree the moss is on and find out where we took a wrong journey.
Okay, the last question, this is a very difficult question, and different people brings out different things. That is, what is going to happen to America in 100 years? You're optimistic, you're pessimistic, just what's going to happen?
Well, I have always been optimistic. I have to be optimistic. I believe that this nation somehow has a rendezvous with destiny, that it was not, you may call this mysticism if you will, it was not by accident, but by divine plan that this continent was placed here for people from every corner of the world who had an extra love of freedom, the courage to follow through with that love, to find their way to this land. And I am convinced that the American people will continue that dream and that we will go on and realize our destiny.
In his short statement, Reagan moves from what is essentially a secular and political definition of the American dream based in certain natural rights, natural political rights, into the other category which I've chosen to open with, and that is the notion of divine mission, divine sending, divine calling, which faces outward from the United States to the world. We have been given an assignment, a task, a holy task, not only to purify the conditions of our own living together, but also to establish a city on the hill which will shed the light of its wisdom, which will present its example to the rest of the world. This blending together of political and religious motives raises certain problems that I am going to be investigating in a separate session on civil religion. There is a second concept of the American dream, very closely related to this, and anticipated in Reagan's opening remarks that I'd now like to turn to. And for this, the key document is not the model of Christian charity, but the Declaration of Independence. And in the middle part of the 18th century, much influenced by the philosophy of John Locke, the American people developed the conviction that there are certain inalienable human rights, among them the rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which must be claimed, and that the tyranny of English rule needed to be thrown off before the people would be free to pursue these rights. In contemporary terms, I think the words equality, equality of opportunity, equality before the law, equality before the law rather than equality of condition, perhaps, are other ways of putting this same term. And the whole complex of ideas surrounding the innate political nature of man and the political mission of the United States makes up a second category of usage in the American Dream. If a document for the first of the American Dreams would be the Bible, a document or an artifact of the second would be a dollar bill, which also lapses over into third American Dream. And I think only here would I find that I didn't have a dollar bill in my pocket and had to run all the way back to the dormitory and get a dollar bill because I haven't carried money for the week I've been upholding. But the dollar and the Bible themselves are interesting playmates. But if you have a dollar bill in your pocket, you could pull it out and notice on one end, on the flip side of the Great Seal of the Republic, is the pyramid overseen by the Eye of God, which indicates the watchful Eye of God and also the release from the Egyptian captivity of the children of Israel who were fleeing to the new land. Underneath the pyramid and the Eye of God is the phrase, Novus Ordo Seclorum.
On the chair.
Ah, there is some chalk. Thank you. Because of the light, I don't think you'd be able to see this anyhow. Novus Ordo Seclorum, which translates as a new order of the ages. And at this time, in the 1770s, when this country was declaring that it was and of rights must be an independent nation, some 3.5 million Americans plus black slaves were declaring that this little ragtag group of 13 colonies was establishing a new order of the ages, not just declaring their own independence, breaking away as rebellious provinces of England, but instead that they were incarnating a political destiny, a political mission, a political model for the use of all mankind, which should then radiate from this country. Much intellectual history has been written about the influence of Puritan thought and separatism upon the development of this notion of political independence also in the United States. But short-circuiting that, I would just declare at this point that, as has been done here, the phrase the American Dream is often used to refer to political rights, political opportunities, particularly equality before the law, equality of opportunity, freedom of the individual, self-determination. This is well articulated by William Buckley in his usual crisp and somewhat sarcastic terms, in a spot on this tape that I'm going to try to find for us.
Some tape that is unspecified.
And that is, to me, the American dream is
something that is unspecifiable in any corporate sense. The American dream is, above all, the possibility for individuals to enact their own dreams in resistance to the whole notion that there should be a collective dream.
What do you think America's goal should be in the next 100 years?
To stay free.
Elaborate, what do you mean by that? How would it do that?
Freedom for the individual, this is the problem. The problem is, of course, that the historical odds are against that happening. And we see this happening in many ways. For instance, the enthusiasm that's shown for totalitarian regimes abroad, suggesting that there are no important distinctions between freedom and a totalitarian state.
One last question, that is, what do you actually predict will happen in the next 100 years? Are you an optimist or a pessimist?
I'm neither. I am an objective pessimist and a subjective optimist. There's every reason to believe that the historical tides are running in the wrong direction. There's also every reason to believe that human beings continue to desire to be free, and that their dominance of nature increases, so that a very good case can be made for either a naturalistic pessimism or a spiritual optimism.
Could you summarize what he said?
To stay free. No, I can't. He's unparaphrasable. The central thrust, though, of Buckley's statement here, as of his entire philosophy also, is libertarian, to protect the freedom of the individual against the inroads of big government or collective society in any sense. And he applies it in different cases, religiously, economically, politically also. But essentially, to resist the growth of large government and the reconstruction, perhaps, of the same complex society that the Puritans first fled from when they came from England in the early 17th century. The third of the American dreams that I'm going to move to now, I think, is the one that is probably may have come first to your minds, even if you didn't express it initially, as our banker friend did. And this is the materialistic phase or definition of the American dream. In other words, the success ethic, the American success story. If the first of the American dreams is religious and spiritual in nature, and if the second is political and deals with basic human rights, the third speaks to the economic condition of man and to his material well-being. And this American dream is best traced to the years following the Civil War until about 1914. Although one of the earliest embodiments of this American dream would be the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin, which was written in the latter part of the 18th century. In the years following the Civil War, 1865, the country underwent a period of very rapid industrial growth, touched off by war demands, also the extension of transportation, the rapid growth of the cities, all of which encouraged the flood of emigration to the United States, which between 1840 and 1914 amounted to about 40 million people. And I guess it's during this period that most of our ancestors came for various motives and at different times. I know that mine certainly did. The success ethic, or the American success story, which assumes individual advancement, achievement, the attainment of prosperity and well-being, is closely linked with the emigration of these years and with the process of socialization which followed it. Such anthropologists as Margaret Mead and sociologists of religion as Will Herbert have declared that Americans are intrinsically a three-generation people, that the first generation to come to this country retained the old world traditions and may have established themselves materially, but did not acculturate to the new country. The second generation, embarrassed by their parents' old world customs, strove to be hyper-American, turning their backs on the customs of the old world, aping the fads and modes of speech and dress of the new country. The third generation then was left somewhat adrift. What did it mean, after all, to be an American? That's a far less concrete label than to be a hyphenated American, an Irish American or German American or Puerto Rican American, whatever it might be. And the third generation have often sought to rediscover the ancestral roots and to own a dual citizenship based both upon the culture which was brought to this country and also the culture which was found here. And accompanying this process of acculturation and self-identity also is material advance. This is very personal to me because I see it so much in my own experience. My great-grandparents had public school educations in Germany. My grandparents, who came to this country to homestead in Minnesota, had no public education here at all. My parents, but did manage to establish a claim in this world and eventually learned to speak English from German. My parents finished high school, or nearly finished high school. My sister, brother, and I have all graduate education. And there is, in educational terms, a steady advance in achievement, and probably in material well-being also, generation from generation. What does this mean for our children, though? What does the fourth generation do? This success ethic assumes continuous ascent beyond the station of one's birth. And if one follows this ethic and this notion, one's final success in life is not so much a matter of how you end your life, the absolute position that you're at, but the distance of ascent or movement from the place of your origin. In other words, it's hard to be a good American if you're born into a very wealthy family, because materially you don't have very far to go. But if you began as a lower working class, the son of a working stiff, you've got all sorts of opportunities in front of you because it's so easy to advance beyond that, through education, through marriage, through geographical mobility, whatever it might be. But all of this assumes a repudiation of the past, of one's origins, and a moving in quest of some luminous but obscure thing called the American Dream. The primary document of this American Dream, aside from the dollar bill, would be the corporate writings of Horatio Alger. And just let me ask, how many of you have read a Horatio Alger story at any time? Okay.
I read them all.
All 130 of them. He was a prolific fellow. But Horatio Alger has fallen out of favor since the 1930s, and when he's read today, it's not as something off the popular circulating library shelf, but as a course requirement most often. Horatio Alger was a Unitarian minister who was disbarred from his church for various kinds of unseemly acts, and set to writing instructional fictional works for young boys. He started in 1869, and by the beginning of the century, he'd written 130 of these pot-boiling books with titles like Struggling Upward, Luck and Pluck, Only an Irish Boy, Mark the Match Boy, Ragged Dick, and so forth, which traced orphaned boys from New Hampshire or Vermont towns who came to New York or to Chicago or went further out west and made it big, or at least made it comfortable. They had the advantage of being fatherless, so they weren't tied down by the point of their origin. And as luck and opportunity would have it in America, they would be encountered on the street by some prosperous businessman who would recognize the unscrubbed virtue in this dirty shoeshine boy, would take him to Sunday school, teach him French, for whatever reason, I don't know, and generally educate him in the ways of the world. And the Horatio Alger boy would outgrow his first substitute father and then be picked up by an even more elevated figure who would finish off the process of acculturation for him, leaving him at the end not a multimillionaire, but somebody well wedded into urban industrial society and probably earning $10,000 a year, which was a lot of money at that time, and for some of us still seems like a lot of money. I've had a harder time among the available interviews locating a spokesman for this dream, because it sounds perhaps too brash and not somehow or the other so respectable, as to speak, for the religious mission or the political mission of America. But I finally settled on the former football coach from the University of Southern California, John McKay, who is now the coach of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And this interview is conducted at a testimonial banquet for John McKay, which may explain some of the sort of maudlin sentimentality of him as he answers questions about his American dream. And look for various stereotypes and cliches that McKay uses. He starts with sports metaphors very appropriately, and although that may not seem too important, it does suggest that the American dream for many people is a game, and that there are rules to the game, and winning is not finally having the biggest score at the end, but it's how you play the game, and the rules of the particular game that he's played throughout his life is struggling upward.
Well, today the American dream is seeing youngsters of all ages, and certainly the youngsters that I have had the privilege of coaching over the years,
play as well as they can play, and whether they win or lose, be very proud of the fact that they have participated in intercollegiate football, and it means so very, very much to our country.
What do you think the goals for the United States should be in the next 100 years?
To be very proud of the people who have gone on before us and try to make sure that what they fought for and died for will always be preserved.
What do you think is going to be happening in the next 100 years to our country, the areas that you're concerned with, and just in general?
Well, my area of concern would be with my grandchildren and other people who will come after I am long gone. And I would just hope that our people would understand that America is the greatest country in the world, and I would just hope and sincerely hope that they would stand for what we have stood for. Sometimes we might have been wrong, but most of the times we've been right, and I love America, and I want my children and my grandchildren to love America.
Do you feel that you personally, this is going to be the last question I'll let you go, do you feel that you personally have come to a spot now in your life where you can say that you fulfilled your American dream?
Well, I came out of the hills of West Virginia to the epiphany in college coaching, and therefore I am living proof that you can do it, or any youngster can do it. There's nobody that came out of a more difficult situation, in my opinion, than I did, and I came to the height of college coaching, and I think anyone can do that if they want to and they work hard enough.
Now, some of you should be able to argue with that. This assumption that America continues to be an absolutely open society with equality of opportunity to all people, regardless of race, sex, or regional origin, is, I think, very, very simplified, to say the least. And it is an American dream that's associated, thankfully, mostly with the 19th century. Particularly since the 1960s, there has been a new American dream emerging, added to the rhetorical arsenal that I've already spread before you, which perhaps could generally be called quality of life, which is neither imperialistic in its religious designs or its political designs, nor is it self-consciously materialistic, but instead is concerned with humanistic values, with what Ben Oni has been presenting this entire week as a holistic approach to life also, which is not competitive or aggressively opposed to the designs of other people. The spokesperson that I've selected for the quality of life dream of the 20th century is Jane Fonda. Whatever else you may think of her and her movie roles in the past, she certainly is articulate at this point. She spoke at the moment that Tom Hayden was waging a unsuccessful senatorial campaign in California, and there will be some references to this also as the tape proceeds. But I would call your attention to the way in which she repudiates the dreams of the past, to identify them as being outmoded, tyrannical, archaic, and then weaves the political, the spiritual, and the material objectives of Americans in earlier periods together into a new holism which points towards the future. Let me play this for you, and then I think we may have a couple minutes for discussion yet.
To me, the American dream is, or rather has been, up until now, the idea that almost anything was possible, that one could strike it rich, that one could go from nothing to everything, everything being defined as being powerful and wealthy, either by being discovered sitting on a bar stool, a la Hollywood, striking a gold mine in the beginning of our westward expansion, branching out into other parts of the world, expanding our national borders. In other words, the American dream has been the dream of expansion, personal and national. I think it's an interesting question to be asked at this particular time, not only because it's the bicentennial, but because for the first time in our history, we've come to the end of the American dream as it's always been conceived, I think. We talk a great deal about this in the course of Tom Hayden's campaign, because it's very much at the root of what's been our past and what has to be our future. I think that with the new realization that people have in this country that our energy is limited, our natural resources are limited, we have only so much fresh air and soil and water left if we're not careful, that other countries in the world don't want us to expand into them anymore. These kind of things have brought us up short. Maybe the perception is only beginning now, but it will increasingly become a very real part of our lives. The economic crisis is a very concrete example of what it means to come to the end of a particular era in our history. And so I think that the American dream is going to have to be redefined at the peril of our future as a nation.
Okay, then what do you think the goal should be for the dream for America?
What I think the new American dream will have to be, and I think that, you know, sensible people will share this this sense. The American dream is going to have to be the improving of the quality of our lives, externally and internally, morally, spiritually, as well as physically and economically. If the expansion into other countries and the expansion into space and the expansion into our soil has drawn itself up to its limits, there is one remaining frontier that is yet to be explored, and that's the quality of our lives. That's in our own humanity. And I think that if we can develop an American dream that's human, that's humanistic, that is caring about other people rather than simply predicated on profit and power, that we will be creating a dream that is not only realizable instead of a false, unrealizable dream for most people, it is a dream that's realizable, that I think will preserve us, that will build us again into a great nation, and will make us all so happy.
Okay, then what?
Beyond these four major American dreams, there are other minor genres which also appear, and which I think you will notice in your reading of billboards and newspapers and watching television and so forth. To name just a couple of these, one is the dream of education, and publications by the federal government as well as journalistic publications often use the label the American dream in referring to the need for and the opportunities for equal education. The phrase appears in reference to bilingual, bicultural education quite often. Another area is that of emigration also and ethnicity. And many of the strongest statements of the power and possibility of the American dream are applied to the acculturation of Chinese Americans and other Asian Americans. And finally also is the dream of a single family dwelling in this country. And the airwaves of Southern California, the billboards of Southern California, have emblazoned Howard Jarvis's admonition to preserve the American dream of the single family home by voting first for Proposition 13, which passed, and then voting for Proposition 9 this last time around, which was defeated. But the American homestead, surrounded by a white picket fence, or perhaps no fence at all, is so closely associated with the middle class ethos of the United States. And in European societies also, distinctions have been made between the working class and between bourgeoisie, or the middle class, based on whether they owned their own home and whether it was a separate dwelling. That this is occupying a more and more frequent place in the parlance of the American dream. There may be others that you know of that you would like to introduce. I would encourage you, when you find essays or publications that use the label the American dream, to read them and then send them to me, the data for my work. Let's say cut it off, my part off at this point, but then to offer an offer. Do we have, I don't have a watch and I can't read the clock in the back. Do we have time for any discussion or should we go to Vesper's time?
4 minutes.
5 minutes.
Luther,
yes.
You had mentioned Martin Luther King, I Have a Dream. Where would you put that in your outlining of the various meaning?
Well, all of these four categories are over simplifications, and I think any one expression that we find, I'm still going to try to quantify with some computer assistance the quantity, either by word count or by emphasis, which these various documents attribute to the various dreams. Martin Luther King's would fall between the first two, I would say. That is, he does see a religious mission for the United States, but unless political rights are extended equally to the country's people, that spiritual mission of the United States cannot be realized.
There's a dimension, though, and that is the picture of a pluralist society rather than a melting pot society, which is a part of that tradition that isn't always present in the four that you outlined.
That's very true. And elsewhere, I've categorized seven American dreams, and one of those is the melting pot. And statistically, that counts quite large also. It's really a murky area, though, because for the last 10 or 15 years, the melting pot has become less and less fashionable. Yeah. And sociologists who use it, who had used it before, prefer to use the Canadian equivalent, the mosaic now, borrowed from Impressionist painting, amongst other things, wherein the elements maintain their separate integrity, although they're mixed together into new patterns.